Welcome to Slab Reliability, the show where we learn about SRE and observability one week at a time. I'm your host, Stephen Townsend. Welcome back to Slab Reliability. I'm Stephen Townsend, and this is a show where we learn about SRE and observability and DevOps now, one week at a time. Today, I'm joined by Dan Sliman. How are you going, Dan?
I'm doing great. I'm super jazzed to be here. I can't wait to talk about whatever we talk about.
I'm excited too. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what do you do and how'd you get there?
Sure. I have been an SRE slash DevOps slash sysadmin, all these things being the same thing really, for the last about 16 years. And I've been working at companies that like Etsy and HashiCorp. Initially, I got my start right out of college with a physics and math degree, physics degree and a math degree. And I just sort of realized I was much better at managing computers than I was at physics and math. So here I am. I've been probably part of hundreds of incidents and thousands of production issue investigations. And now it's now.
So it's really timely that we're having this conversation because in my own work, I'm putting together for a large program of work an environment strategy. And as part of that, I've had to think about these big integrated end-to-end shared testing environments and how are we going to operate them effectively? And what are the ways of working required to do that? And one of the things that has come up is the need to have some kind of incident management involved. It's just defined. Because I think often in our test environments and during delivery, we don't think about it. We think, oh, that's for production. But these environments are a critical path to delivering for the program. So I'm thinking about incident management, and I'm coming to you for advice. Where do I begin setting up an incident management, I don't know what you call it, process, tooling, framework, whatever you want to call it. Where do I start? Because I don't have experience working on call in production.
A lot of people don't know where to start. You're not alone. I've called it an incident response protocol before, but the words don't matter so much. I would say that if you're working in any environment where there are stakeholders who need to be kept informed and in the loop on any failure of the system, then you need some kind of incident response process. And if you don't have one defined, then you have the default one, which is everybody panics. So you want to avoid having that one. If you Google your question, where do I get started for incident response, you'll get a lot of software tools, and some of them are good, some of them are fine, some of them are not so good. But I would recommend anybody who's looking at this stuff start with a process that can be defined as documentation and as training materials. So the minimal incident response process is probably if you see something that merits an incident, then here's the check. Here's a link to the checklist, and the checklist is something like start a Slack channel, start a Zoom or a video call of some sort, and announce yourself in the channel as, "Hi, I'm in charge of this incident. Please join the channel to talk about it." Having that process be well known and easily accessible to people, it gives you maybe 60 to 70% of the value of having a totally buttoned up incident response process. Just the fact that people know what to do when they see a problem is a huge, huge sea change from nobody knowing what to do.
I think having that one person maybe who can coordinate that, you know, so being that person you just said who jumps on the chat and says, "Hi, I'm looking after this incident here, let's get together and figure it out." I've been thinking, as part of my strategy, I have put down this role. It's not like a a job role. It's more like a role that needs to be fulfilled at times of incident commander. Because I think in our organization, we have these very complex solutions where there might be 10 different teams involved and with different components that make up a service which is having an issue. And so having someone who, even if they are in one of those teams, who steps out for a second and has that solution view and says, I'm going to think end-to-end about this incident and keep an objective mind as opposed to trying to solve it at the component level and not seeing the big picture. Do you think is my thinking there in the right place?
Absolutely. If you have a single person who is in charge of the incident, that person can, of course, delegate different responsibilities to different people, and they should, depending on the complexity of the incident. But if you don't have that person, then people start to run around like chickens with their heads cut off, because who do you talk to? Who's making the decisions, and whose job is it to? The way I see the incident commander's main job is to keep the incident moving forward. If there's no person whose responsibility that is and who's empowered to delegate and keep people all, you know, working on the appropriate jobs, then incidents can really just sort of stall out.
When we caught up last week, you mentioned this thing which has really popped out at me, which is this idea of clinical troubleshooting and applying some of the concepts that we use in the field of medicine in hospitals, or you know, when there's an emergency, and applying them to the world of incident management. Can you elaborate a bit more about that?
Sure. So I happened upon this idea because I saw a talk at Velocity in 2012 by Steve Bennett of Demon Software, and then also my spouse is a veterinarian, and in vet school she did a lot of what's called problem-based learning courses, where the teachers would sort of teach the students how to reason about unknown problems and how to do diagnosis formally. So you would be shown a picture, you'd be given a write-up of, you know, a patient presented with these symptoms, and it's this kind of dog, and it's this old. What do you think might be the issue here? You work on that. You'd think about that for a while. I'd refer to your textbooks, and then you'd give your best few guesses, and then the professor would introduce another piece of information, and you'd have to go back and say, oh, well, given that piece of information, what do I think now? Hearing about this through my spouse, I thought, well, this is very similar to what we do in ops, where we have a complex system that is doing something unexpected. We have a team of experts who know about different parts of the system, but nobody has the whole picture, and we have to work together to come up with an explanation for why this weird thing is happening. So I should copy some of these ideas, and that's what I've done successfully for the rest of my career.
I took some notes about what we talked about last time. Yeah, and it makes so much sense to me. So, like you just said, the first thing you do is, well, what are the symptoms? Or in the case of incident management, I guess the facts as well, because you might have some cold hard facts, like, I don't know, all of the servers are up and running. We can, you know, from a hardware perspective or something. I don't know. There might be some facts that you can feed into it, which can reduce things down. And then it's about coming up with hypotheses to explain those symptoms, and then putting together a set of actions to rule out one or more of those hypotheses. Like, that is so clear. It seems so simple. Yet I can imagine in the heat of the moment, so difficult to do.
It can be, but it can also be the antidote to panic. If you have an incident where nobody, I've been in a lot of incident calls where people are, the first thing we tried didn't fix the problem. And so everybody just sort of sits in radio silence for a few minutes being like, huh, so one of the tools available to an incident commander can be this formal process where we explicitly go through all these steps, and that keeps progress happening. So the steps are, as you say, figure out what the observable symptoms are. This is not try to minimize supposition or hypothesizing in this part. You're just saying, what did we objectively observe? This number went from this value to this value at this time. These servers are unreachable by SSH, that sort of thing. Then, you know, together as a group looking at the same document, you say, all right, now what are our hypotheses? What could possibly be happening that explains all of these findings? And you try to come up with at least two of those, because if you only have one and you prove that one wrong, well, you're back to square one. So you try to come up with at least two, as many as you can in the group. This is why it helps to have a bunch of people in the room with different expertises, because they'll all come up with different ideas. And then finally, not finally, because it's a cycle, but the last step of the cycle is you decide, all right, well, given these hypotheses, what action can we take? What test can we do to rule out one or more of these hypotheses, and who's going to do those actions? You just go from there, you cycle back to the first step, add the new information to the symptom list, and keep going until you have an answer.
Oh, yeah, I did want to get your thoughts on incident management in non-prod environments, because that's kind of my world at the moment. I'm not working in production yet. I'm sure that will come in the future when we have a solution which is live, but for the meantime, I'm trying to help this very large, important program of work succeed and deliver without too many interruptions. They're inevitable, right? Things are going to go wrong, but how can we minimize that? Do you think there is a place for incident management in the non-production context?
Completely. Well, like I said, anytime you have stakeholders who need to be kept informed of what's going on with a problem, you need some kind of process to handle that. And there's no reason you can't use the same process that is used for incident management in production, as long as it's clear to the stakeholders which incidents, you know, you don't want to create an incident like the build. This build is broken and we need to, you know, fix something about the infrastructure internally. You don't want people to see the CEO to see that and jump in the call, right? But as long as that is all clear to people, the general process is the same. You need somebody to be in charge of seeing the incident through to completion. That person will need to delegate the responsibilities, will probably need to delegate at least some of the responsibilities of doing communication of stakeholders to a liaison persona, the responsibility of keeping notes on the effort and what's been tried, what hasn't been tried, and what the current state is to a sort of scribe persona. And of course, the actual technical investigation work to subject matter expert.
I'm guessing that scribe role is one of the areas that tooling can be quite helpful. I'm guessing, but I guess you don't need it. I'm guessing you could, if you really wanted to, have it on a bit of paper if you were in the office. But
sure, you can. So a lot of the tooling that exists for incident response tries to fill that role, and it fills it with varying degrees of success. I've used a tool called Blameless that uses, essentially you use your Slack channel as the notes document, and then you respond, you react with certain emojis, and that tells this tool to load that information into the timeline so that you can, when you review it later, you can see what happened in what order. I find it's very hard to replace it. You know, I'm a workflows over technologies kind of person. So I end up being much happier when a human's doing the scribe role, because the timeline part, sure, a tool can do parts of that, but a human has the unique ability to recognize which things, where in the story, where in the narrative of the incident there are turning points that are important for other people's understanding of the issue. And a human can say, all right, well, the person who comes into this incident half an hour into it is going to want to look at this doc and going to want a clear understanding of where we are and what we've tried so far and what matters to their understanding, which if you're just clicking on star emojis on messages in the chat as you go, doesn't really work as well, because you're going to star a lot of things that end up being irrelevant to the problem solving effort half an hour or even 5 minutes later.
It's not a really fair question because it's like a very complex scenario, but how do you reduce the noise and get to the point where you can manage that incident in a way which doesn't pull in lots of unnecessary people?
This is one of the reasons why having an incident commander, a single incident commander who's in charge of the incident, is so critical. If only because that person becomes like a gate through which the information has to pass in order to become part of the incident, and the gate has a certain rate at which information can pass into it. A person can only process new information so fast, and if you want to contribute your finding to the incident commander has to process it. The incident command role, the Slack channel, and the video call, you know, the audio channel of the video call, can all function as, I'm not sure what the right word in electronic signals engineering is, but they can all function to set a, you know, informational sort of speed limit on the conversation. And what that does is it forces people with less critical information to evaluate, well, do I want to speak up right now and interrupt the person who's talking, or do I want to be the next person to grab the conch, so to speak? Should I take my observation away and get it more into, you know, a real shape where I can discuss it efficiently? Or should I just go away entirely because having listened to this conversation, it's not, my thing is not relevant?
I've been thinking that part of it actually is observability, because if you have this is a base level of observability, and it's almost less observability and more about tracking service levels to a degree. You know what I mean? Like, if I can see each of these systems and get a basic overall health overview of each of the components that make up the system, it's probably going to give me a starting point and to know which teams to begin a conversation with. Whereas if I'm blind, if I can't see anything at all as an incident commander, I'm going to have to engage everyone and get them to provide me all the information.
Yes, you absolutely need that, but it's not sufficient. There are many occasions when a problem will occur and everything looks green. All the health indicators all appear to be just fine because, for example, maybe you get a ticket that says, we received a report that, you know, one out of every 20 requests for this page is timing out. Or if you send this particular payload, you get an error. Those are not going to affect a health dashboard because it's only a special case. It's not all the traffic is down or all the traffic is working. So a health dashboard is not sufficient in figuring out which team needs to talk about what. To bring back the idea of clinical troubleshooting, what happens when you have a coherent record of the troubleshooting effort in the form of your symptoms, hypotheses, and actions you're taking, it is twofold. The first part is because you have identified the hypotheses about what might explain the issue, you can easily identify, well, if it's that one, we need to talk to this team. You know, if one of our hypotheses is, oh, there's a problem with this cache that is in part of this subsystem, you could say, oh, we'll find the team that owns that subsystem, bring them in, and so on. And then also, it becomes a lot easier to collaborate across those team boundaries, and you can do it more efficiently because you don't have to get them totally up to speed by telling them the whole history or asking them to read the Slack channel. You can show them what the current state of your thinking is, and they can get up to speed and usually immediately say, yeah, this looks like it's probably part of my subsystem, or no, this definitely isn't part of my subsystem.
Last time we caught up, you gave me some other advice I thought was super helpful and something I'm absolutely going to implement as part of my work in the coming weeks and months, which is when you, it's about that scribe role you talked about, having a standard format for tracking what we've learned about the incident as we go, so that as new teams and people come on board, they're really familiar with that format, and so they can quickly digest it and get up to speed. And also just to that cuts down on that noise, that communication overhead and need to blast out to everyone. I think that's super, such a good idea. And once again, because I'm a total noob at this stuff, it's super helpful.
There's this thing called the fundamental common ground breakdown, which there's some papers about, you can probably find on Sci-Hub. But the essentially is what happens when you have two or more people who are collaborating on a, on an effort that involves joint cognition, thinking together about what, about how to solve a problem. And there's some piece of information that one of them has that the other doesn't have. So the person who has this extra piece of information will go off and do one thing. The person who doesn't have it may follow that effort. They may go off and do their own thing. They don't even know what question to ask. They don't even know that they should ask a question to get their mental state back into line with the person who has the information, because they don't know they don't have it. It hasn't been expressed. And their worldviews, although their actions may coincide, their worldviews can get further and further apart from each other until suddenly one of them performs an action that's just comes totally out of the blue for the other person, because they're working with two totally different pictures of what's going on. That's called the fundamental common ground breakdown. If you have a standard format in which you're expressing the current state of the problem solving effort, and that's distinct from a history of what has happened, you know, like a Slack channel, but like a, here's what we're thinking about it, here are the facts we're taking into account, the possible explanations for those facts and why we're going to do what we're going to do, then anything that's on there is relevant for anybody newly joining the effort to consume, and it gets their head pretty much right in the same place that everybody else's head is at. And anything that's not on there is essentially not part of the problem-solving effort, or somebody would have spoken up and added it to the doc.
I like that you take concepts from outside the world of technology, you know, around psychology or medicine. And I don't think enough people do that. And I don't do that enough in my own work. So that's cool. I like that.
The SRE field is full of people of all different kinds of walks of life. You know, it's you can always find somebody with a slightly different perspective of than your own on the work, because they've come from a slightly different background. And so I listen to people a lot, and I try to synthesize it into general. I try to like synthesize it by writing into general principles that work for me.
I thought we'd finish with something a little fun. Can you tell us about looking for trouble?
Sure. Yeah. So at my last job, which was HashiCorp, I was on a team that would pull developers into a rotation on a weekly basis, and we would just together do what was called looking for trouble. So semi-formal process where we would look at whatever piece of telemetry the person I was working with wanted to look at. For example, let's look at the traces for this API endpoint and sort by, so to find the slowest ones or the fastest ones or the ones with this error, or let's look at the log entries and find and look at the, what are the, you know, biggest response bodies that we send. And then we would just take whatever we found there, and we would go down that rabbit hole using the clinical troubleshooting process to try to explain what we were seeing. And this became a very, very important facet of our reliability approach for our product, because when we chased down these outliers, we would very often find that whatever surprising thing we noticed was actually a symptom of something that was a problem or was going to become a problem in the future. I like to think of the production system exposed to customer traffic as like a big bucket of problems that are bouncing around. Some of them get bad enough that they come and pop out of the bucket, and then we see that there's a problem and we go, oh no, make an incident, or then we go chase them down. But through this looking for trouble process, we found a lot of issues that were like, oh, that really shouldn't be happening. And if we fix it now, then we can prevent it from recombining with some other unexpected behavior to become an outage in the future.
I think that's really cool. It's almost like a twist on the game day idea, but taking it like a step further and actually working with, because you're working with real production situations, and it brings back memories of performance engineering and investigating and trying to diagnose complicated, difficult to detect performance issues. For me, that's kind of exciting work for me. So that's really cool.
It was one of the most rewarding things I've done in my career. It's a rare problem that just appears all at once. They tend to be magnifications over time of things that the system is already doing. So it's very rewarding to just get in there, find the problems, and get your system running ship shape.
This episode was sponsored by Squared Up. Squared Up combines all your data with awesome dashboards, analytics, health roll-ups, and notifications into a unified observability portal. Using a data mesh architecture, Squared Up is a beautifully simple way to get instant access to the insights that matter whenever you need them. If you want to know more, head over to squaredup.com to sign up for your free account. Thank you so much, Dan, for coming on the show. I've loved the conversation, and you have a blog, don't you? Tell us about that.
I do. Thank you for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure. My blog is blog.danslimon.com. Get on there. I blog about SRE topics, incident response, collaborative troubleshooting concepts, and I'm always looking for new readers to ask me challenging questions in the comments. So please, by all means.
I'll put a link to your blog in the description of this episode. And yeah, talking about that, I'm actually thinking of starting a blog myself, because I'm moving into this new world of technology leadership, for the lack of a better term. And so although SLA reliability is where the SRE, the reliability stuff goes, I wanted a place to talk about broader technology leadership concepts. So thinking about
doing it, man. I can't wait to hear your thoughts.
Yeah. Thanks once again for coming on the show, Dan. I'd love to chat again in the future, actually. I think there's more that we could cover.
I can tell. We can talk for hours and hours if we were allowed to. So I can't wait.
And to everyone else out there, I hope you have a wonderful week, and I'll see you all next time.